welcome to this God-inspired message from Shofar Christian Church. We trust that you will enjoy today's message and that it will encourage you to grow deeper in your relationship with Christ our Savior.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for this privilege to be here and to be able to share with you about servant leadership, and specifically, as Philip has said, the neuroscience of servant leadership. I had the choice today to give you a lot of theory on servant leadership, but I think in this graveyard shift this time of the afternoon, too much theory would not go down too well. So what I want to do today is I want to speak to you about servant leadership, but I want to briefly share with you a couple of principles on servant leadership, which is also you find on the handout. And then I want to very briefly talk to you about the basics again of neuroscience. Is this S coming through? The basics of neuroscience, which will just bring you on the sort of the page where you'll understand the significance of findings in neuroscience related to leadership. So what I'm basically saying to you is that for a very long time, for 2,000 years, the church had a leadership model, namely the servant leadership example of Jesus. And for a very long time, for some reason, and we can go, you can write a couple of books and develop theologies around the reasons why the church itself, the majority, the largest part of the church, never really adopted that leadership style. But about 40-odd years ago, a guy called Robert Greenleaf wrote and published an article. And in this article, what he said was that as a leader, your focus should be your followers. And when this article first came out, a lot of leaders, a lot of leadership theorists, academics scoffed at Greenleaf, saying, how is it possible that you want to serve people? You want the bottom line. You want results. You want to make money. So if you want to make money, you have to drive people. And so for years, that has been, and in some cases still is, the way that we lead people, this top-down command and control leadership style, where leaders use sources of power related to their position. So if I'm the CEO, if I'm the manager, or I'm the captain, or I'm the whatever, that position gives me the authority to manipulate and to force you to comply with what I want from you. And so if you look at leadership development, it's very sad if a leader gets stuck in that place where they always use sources of power related to their position. And you'll find that a lot of leaders do that. I used to do that with my children. Why? Let's ask why. Because I'm the father. No, because I'm your dad. But that's the typical what we do is to use, what leaders do, is to use those sources of power to enforce or to force people or lead people in the way that we want them. And so Greenleaf looked at corporate America, and he looked at how the world was changing and how more and more he saw that command and control leadership style was not effective anymore. It was not getting the results that it used to get 50 and 80 years before that. And there's a whole lot of reasons why this was changing. One of those was the fact that we moved from the old, from the industrial era where everybody just had a little job. You had to just hit the nail into the whatever or work the machine. So there was very little thinking needed from the average employee. But so as we moved into a new era where information and information technology is driving a lot of work, we need people to be engaged. We need people to think. We need people to be creative. Now, this applied in 1970 when Greenleaf first came up with his theory on servant leadership. How much more does it apply now? Now, that's a completely different lecture. What I want to quickly then do is just for you to have a look at the 10 characteristics of servant leadership. Now, servant leadership, as I say, is basically a relational leadership. So it's where the leader, instead of standing at the top and cracking the whip, the leader actually has a relation with people and look after people and care for people and show respect to people and interact with people. Be a human being. Now, one of the things that people often misunderstand about servant leadership, and specifically about the leadership style of Jesus, is that servant leadership doesn't mean that you just, you know, stand around hugging everyone, loving everyone. Servant leadership also has a goal component. So you want to get somewhere, you want to get results. So if you look at the bigger picture, servant leadership is about building into the people, developing people, but with an end goal in mind. Jesus didn't come to earth just to spend time with disciples and, you know, have a good time here, do some things. And then he had throughout his ministry, throughout the 30-odd years that he spent on earth, he was goal-orientated. He was always working to fulfill that purpose, the reason why he was on earth. And so if you see the way that he interacted with his disciples, he showed them love, he served them, he washed their feet, but it was always with a goal in mind, to enable them to establish, to build the church, which we have today, which is the greatest, and I'm talking from a secular perspective, the greatest, the largest organization in the world, from what the input that he gave in the lives of those 12, well, 11 of them really made it, of those 11 leaders. So here's a couple of characteristics of servant leadership, and I'm not going to discuss each of these. Servant leadership, listening, the ability of a leader to really listen to people. Why do you want to listen to people? You want to show them respect, and you want to get the input. So different from the old crack the whip, just do as I say approach. Secondly, empathy, showing people that you care, showing people that you feel for them, being aware of people's feelings, aware of what people are experiencing. Healing is about having a mindset where you care, where you want to help people to grow, to develop, to be whole. Help people to be what they can be. Awareness is to be aware of what people are experiencing, aware of what's going on in the world around you, aware of what's going on in the organization or the group that you are leading. Persuasion is very important in this model. Persuasion is the way that servant leaders influence people. In the old days, or the old leadership model, the crack the whip, command and control model, the leader said, this is how it will be, and that was the call, and that's how it was. In servant leadership, the idea is to collaborate, so to persuade, and to get input from others, and to respect the views of others. So the servant leader, instead of that old model where the leader supposedly knows everything, the servant leader facilitates input. So the servant leader, the leadership role is very much different. The servant leader is not expected to know everything, but the servant leader facilitates processes, decision-making processes, and get input from other people. Conceptualization and futuristic or futuring, having future foresight, very close to each other. This is where the servant leader has a bigger picture and knows where we're going and see the whole picture and see where he wants to take or she wants to take followers. So it's about a big picture mentality, a big picture mind that can see the bigger picture, doesn't just get stuck into the here and the now. Then we've got stewardship, also very important. The servant leader is not just concerned about his own people, himself, his organization, but he takes responsibility. He's a steward, a shepherd for everything within his sphere. So to really embrace people and to really take responsibility, which is very important. Then the ninth one is commitment to the growth of people. Again, very important. This characteristic of servant leadership is about helping people develop, again, helping people to become everything they can be, really develop into their fullness. And the servant leader, instead of leaving that to the individual, the servant leader help people to along their journey, to identify their strengths, help them to find their strengths, and help them to develop those strengths and apply those strengths. And then finally, building community. So that feeling of us, that inclusiveness. So to help to make even in workplaces to create an environment where people feel this is us. I'm part of this. I'm part of this community. And so these are just very briefly just 10 characteristics of servant leadership and I'm just sharing that with you, and I gave you the handout so that you have that in the back of your mind when I talk about neuroscience and the application of neuroscience to leadership. Guys, we've really come to a place in the history, like, well, I suppose every time in history is unlike any other time in history, but we've really come to a critical moment in history right now. In the history of mankind, there's been three large revolutions. There's been the agrarian revolution, the industrial revolution, and the printing, before that, the printing revolution. And those three revolutions really changed the way that people live. Really changed, it made a big impact on just about everything. But right now, we are in what observers call the fourth revolution. And this fourth revolution, the impact of this fourth revolution that we are living in right now, is set to be greater than the combined impact of the first three revolutions. And this revolution is the technology revolution, information revolution. And among other things, what is happening as a result or part of this revolution is, in the past, for centuries, change used to be very slowly and linear. So things changed very slowly, one thing followed upon the other, very slowly, very predictable, and very manageable when change occurs slowly. Now and then something happened, then there was a bit of an increase. But if you look at mankind's history over thousands of years, it's a slow, linear, predictable process. Right now, as a result of this technological revolution, the rate of change has increased exponentially, and it's still doing so. So more things are changing faster than ever before. And so if you think of leadership, and whether it's leadership in the church, or leadership in an organization, or leadership at home, to deal with change is difficult because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And the one leader, one person, doesn't have all the ability or all the knowledge or all the input. In the past, if I had a factory, 50 years ago, if I had a factory made shoes, once I learned how to make shoes, I was okay. I'm the boss. Do it this way. You just do it the way I'm telling you to do it. But now, if I'm making shoes, the way that I made shoes yesterday might not be effective tomorrow, because I'm competing with China and India and the rest of the world. So I need input from people. So more than ever, when we talk about leadership, we need a leadership style that is able to facilitate input, to get people to really give what they can, to contribute. So that control and command style is not working anymore. It's not effective anymore. So if you look at what leadership, just a couple of months ago, the McKinsey Quarterly, it's a very, well, probably the world's largest management consulting magazine and company. The company, the magazine is just the outlet. Did a survey among top leaders in the world, and it was interesting that those leaders of the top companies, so many of those leaders came to a point where they said, we just don't know. Because so many things are changing, we're just not sure where this is going. Where these great men in the face of the public, if you look at them on the news or whatever, in the Business Times, they seem to know exactly what's happening. But in fact, these guys are experiencing a crisis. And so the world is experiencing a crisis. And I want to go so far and say many churches also experience a crisis in terms of leadership. Because for some reason, we've been very slow, now I'm talking about the church, very slow to embrace the leadership model that Jesus gave us. So so let's talk about neuroscience. Very briefly, neuroscience is the science of studying the brain and the nervous system. So in the beginning, neuroscience originally looked at people that had brain damage, that had all kinds of brain diseases, and studied that. But in the last decade or so, a lot of neuroscience scientists shifted their focus to the healthy brain. And so what they're doing is to study the human brain under normal circumstances. And what enabled this and led to a lot of breakthroughs and new knowledge and I want to say on a weekly basis, new discoveries are being made, is that new technology was devised that enables them to scan the brain, to really look at the brain and monitor processes as we interact with each other. So look at the brain, and understand what parts of the brain deals with what, and so on and so on. So just very briefly, human being has about 100 billion brain cells. This is just to set the picture. You've got about 100 billion brain cells, and these brain cells connect with each other. There's one brain cell. The brain cell at the top, you see those little thing that looks like a tree. Those are dendrites. And how it communicates is that it sends an electrochemical signal from the dendrites, which are connected to other brain cells, down the axon and into the axon terminal. And then between different brain cells, there's a little gap, a synapse, and the communication there is through what they call neurotransmitters, which are hormones. So your brain communicates or carries signals through electrical current and through these neurotransmitters. Okay, when you're born, your brain is just a mass of brain cells, and as you develop, different brain cells. If a child learns to kick a ball, first they wants to fall over. And then as he practices that a couple of times, it gets better. That what happens is the brain cells that runs from the motor part, that controls the motor part of the body, those brain cells form networks. And then as those networks get stronger, you get better at what you do. So the brain works with these networks. It's like a cable system or a electrical or a computer with all the different little wires connecting different parts and being responsible for different actions. So this is just the basic working of the brain. Now, as I was saying, in the last couple of years, the new technology has enabled neuroscientists to really understand the brain. So for example, here at the top left, you see the little red dot there. That's the part of the brain that's activated when you see something. So the visual part of the brain. Then at the top right, hearing. And the bottom left, speaking, when you speak, and then at the bottom right, thinking and speaking. So in this way, they understand what happens in different parts of the brain at different circumstances. There's an example of, at the top, a healthy brain, looking at the social part, the part of the brain that deals with social events, social interaction. Healthy brain, and at the bottom, the brain of someone with schizophrenia. And so you can see that brain is not activated. Those parts of the brain works differently. So just for interest sake. So that's just the background on... Why do I keep on doing that? The background on neuroscience that you need to know to understand what I'm going to share with you next. If you think about the brain, your brain, the brain, the human brain, what do you think is the... Why do you have a brain? What's the primary purpose of a brain? Just to keep you alive, yes? Yeah, anyone else? Sorry? To control everything else, yeah? Okay? You're right. The basic principle of the brain, the primary purpose of having a brain is to survive. It's to keep us alive. So in the last couple of years, neuroscience applied to the social environment, discovered three important things. There are three important findings, three key findings in neuroscience that has really changed the way that we understand leadership and that we understand interaction, human interaction in general. And I say change, in some instances it's confirmed things. For instance, it's confirmed the validity of servant leadership, but in other cases it's giving us red lights saying we're not doing this right. Those key findings, first of all, the organizing principle of the brain, the basic way in which the brain function is by responding to threats and rewards. Okay? Basic organizing principle of the brain, threats and the rewards. And I'll explain that in a minute. Secondly, the social brain. The fact that our brains, believe it or not, your brain is basically a social organ. So most of human behavior is driven by neurochemical responses to social circumstances. Does that make sense? So what happens in the social environment, your brain has automated responses to that. And that drives a lot of your behavior. And then thirdly, neuroplasticity, which basically says, the old story I grew up hearing, once you are out of your teenage years, your brain stops growing and your brain is the way it is. It's absolutely not true. We're finding out now your brain constantly grows new brain cells and it constantly changes and it can change. Because our behavior is formed by those networks, those neurological networks. And so those networks can be changed. So that's quite a significant discovery in terms of changing the way we live, changing the way we behave. So you said quite rightly that survival is the basic principle or the basic purpose of the brain. And our brains keep us alive in two ways. First of all, it manages the physiological processes in our body. So it regulates your heartbeat, it works with your body temperature, your breathing, all the different functions of your body is regulated and managed by your brain. So that's the one way in which it keeps us alive, to keep your physiological, this body, running. The second way in which it keeps us alive is to constantly scan for threats and rewards. Okay? To constantly scan for threats and rewards. So, as I said to you just now, the organizing principle of the brain, the primary driving principle of the brain, is to keep you alive. So what happens is, as you grow up, throughout your life, when you encounter certain things, your brain labels that thing as either a threat or a reward. Okay? It happens when you first encounter something. That labeling happens. So your brain, it works like this. If I can quickly draw a brain of a face here. Okay. There's my man. And he's got a brain. Okay. So in your brain, you've got a part in the brain's about here that deals with emotions, the limbic system. And the limbic system has two little parts called the amygdala. The amygdala is one on the one side and another one on the other side. Two little almond-shaped thingies. And they regulate long-term memory. So the first time when you saw a fire and somebody said, your mother or your father said, don't touch it, your amygdala triggered an emotional response and it labeled a fire as a dangerous thing and it caused a withdrawal response. And every time since then, when you see a fire or when you see something that can hurt you, it causes that withdrawal response because it's a threat. It was labeled as a threat. Remember this, when you see a fire, you know logically, with your conscious mind, you know it's a danger. But that part of this process here is not in your conscious mind. It's an automated neurological process. If I walk out this door, and I open the door, front there, and there is a lion, roaring lion, what am I going to do? I'm not going to stand there and say, I wonder, this guy looks unfriendly. What should I ask? I'm gonna be right here behind all of you in a flash. I'm gonna be gone in a flash. And that's part of this automated withdrawal response where my brain has long ago somewhere labeled a lion as a danger. And so the moment I see a lion, I'm faced with that danger. The amygdala triggers that response before I think. My brain saves me. So I can fight, flee, or freeze. One of the three ways in which people respond to danger. Okay? When I see encounter a physical threat. On the other hand, if I encounter a physical reward, ice cream or, I don't know, biltong or something nice, I want to engage with it. I draw to it. Right? So, now the problem is this. We've always known, or for a long time, this fight or flight response has been known. We always know that we talk about the survival instinct. So for a long time, we've known about the survival instinct in the physical environment when encountering a guy with a gun or a lion or a fire or whatever else. But what neuroscience has now revealed, and this is really not quite radical in terms of how we interact with people. What real neuroscience has revealed now is that the same neurological networks, the same triggers which are triggered when you encounter a physical danger, exactly the same networks, the same automated responses are triggered when you encounter a threat in the social environment. Get that? When you interact with people and people respond in certain ways that your brain perceives that as a threat, not threatening you with a knife, insulting you, or threatening your status, or threatening or treating you in an unfair way, the same neurological processes are triggered. And your brain withdraws. So you stand in the class, and the teacher asks you something. I mean, I remember situations like that in school. Think back when you were in school. And the teacher asks you something, and it's a teacher that you know, this guy is not the friendliest person, or he's known as a bully or whatever, you get a couple of those. And you feel threatened. And they ask you, I remember we used to do small summer tables. Multiplications, yeah. And you try and answer, and he goes through the class like that. Okay, 5 times 7, 9 times 12. And you wait for it. And he asks you, the finger, I mean, it's just gone. And 5 minutes before, you could have answered that. What happened? That person, your brain labeled that person as a threat. The moment when that threat happened, the following occurred. Your brain, the front outer part of your brain is called the prefrontal cortex. This red area. It's just a layer of about 2 centimeters, and it's just in the front, just above your eyes. The prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain that deals with your conscious thought. So your ability to discern between right and wrong. Your ability to solve problems. Your ability to memorize. Your ability to remember. Your ability to discern between good and bad. Your ability to make plans. All of that happens in the prefrontal cortex. And it's one thing that distinguishes us from animals. Other mammals also have a prefrontal cortex, but it's much less developed than the human prefrontal cortex. Now, the prefrontal cortex, because it deals with higher thought or higher brain functions, like thinking creatively and solving problems, things that animals can't do, it takes a lot of energy. In fact, it takes about 20% of the energy in your brain. Now, here's the problem. When you are in a stress situation or a threat situation, the following happens in your brain. The amygdala is triggered, or the amygdala triggers the fight or flight response, okay? And the moment that it triggers that, it withdraws critical resources from the prefrontal cortex. Things like sucrose and oxygen and you know other nutrients from the prefrontal cortex and pushes this into the rest of the other parts of the brain that helps you to fight this animal, this threat. So your heart starts pounding, your breathing increases, your eyes, your pupils dilate, you get goosebumps on your skin. The larger muscles in your body gets activated, so your blood vessels in the larger muscles gets larger. More blood there so you can run or fight or whatever. So when that fight or flight the response is triggered, you actually become stupid. It's the truth. So think about situations where you argued with somebody and somebody asked you in this, and then later you lay in bed and you think, why the heck didn't I answer that and that and that? I had to answer. I know, why didn't I say that and that and that? Why didn't you say it? Because fight or flight was triggered. You were right. You were ready to fight this tiger. Your brain was fighting this tiger or elephant or bear or whatever it was. It thought that was. For the brain, it's the same in the social environment, the same threat as in the physical environment. So your brain is not concerned. Your brain wants to keep you alive. So it's not concerned whether or not you can multiply whatever when you're in danger. It wants to keep you alive. And so now here's the thing. In this, if we understand this, then we understand the consequences when we trigger the fight or flight in people that we are leading. And my question to leaders is always, so what do you want to do? Do you want to win the argument, or do you want your people to perform at their best? Because when the fight or flight is triggered, as I say, conscious thought is impaired, weakened ability to understand, decide, remember, etc., etc., make more mistakes, functioning just takes a huge dive. And so if I want the people to function at their best, now remember I said to you, we're living in this time, in this fourth revolution where everything is changing, where we don't just want people to just not think and just do whatever we pay them for. We want them to be engaged. We want people in the, Conrad talked about the church earlier, and I was impressed with it. I hear engagement, I hear people are active, they're involved, and that's what you want. And if you can look at the leadership style, I don't know anything about, and I've never been to the church, but I can tell you that there's a leadership style that does not trigger the fight or flight. There's a leadership style that triggers a reward response. That is why people are engaged. So even, you know, looking not just at the spiritual part of it, but also at a physiological, neurological, from that angle, we can lead the choices to lead people in a way that engages them, or to lead people in a way that causes a threat. And that's really the choice that we have as leaders. Now the social brain, very briefly, the social brain just, as I mentioned earlier, just says that so many of our responses, the way that we react, the way that we behave, is really driven by these neurological processes, by these labels that we have. I wish I had time to share with you on diversity, on race, how our brains label my people, my group, my in-group, and any other group. Doesn't matter if it's race or language or anyone who's different. Somebody with dreadlocks, somebody with a skinhead, somebody with thingies in their nose, nostrils, and stuff. Not my people. Danger. Then I behave in a hostile way towards them. And it's not about what I think. It's a neurological, automated neuro response. And it's quite interesting. It can be changed. It should be changed. We should manage it. It helps to just know it. Excuse me. So what I want to just finally share with you. Okay, on that line. Talking about diversity and different groups, just for interest sake, sharing this. This was an experiment that was done at a university in China. And what they did is that participants, Chinese and Caucasian European participants. And what they did, the participant went and they sat down, and on the screen, they saw a picture on the left. They saw a picture of either a Caucasian person, a European face, being prodded in the face with a needle. Right? Or they saw a picture of a Chinese person being prodded with a needle. And then, as they were sitting there, they had a scanner, a brain scanner on. And what they found, what the researchers found, that when the Chinese person saw another Chinese person getting hurt, getting stuck in the face with a needle, the part of their brain that feels pain, that would have lightened up when they themselves were stuck with a needle, that part of their brain lightened up. So here's what you can learn from that. First of all, when we see somebody that we identify with suffer, we physically, our brain physically, feel the same pain, which is quite radical. On the other hand, people, when the Chinese participant was sitting and seeing a Caucasian being prodded in the face, very little response. And vice versa. So the brain chemically, the brain didn't respond. So now we talk about empathy. So why do you feel empathy for somebody that you identify with? It's not about race. It's about who you identify with. Who you feel, who's my people. So if you feel your people getting hurt, or you see that or you perceive that, you feel empathy. It's easier to feel empathy because it's a neurological process, that empathy that you're feeling. But if it's somebody from another group, somebody that you don't identify with, it's more difficult to feel empathy. This is how our brains have been created. Rewiring, as I said, it's possible, and specifically when we talk about diversity and different groups, not talking from a spiritual point of view, but just from a neurological point of view, two ways to change it. The one is to change your thinking. So in other words, if you believed, what are those guys, Nation of Islam, and Israel, I don't know, what. Those far outlandish people that believe their race or their group is the chosen, is the only, if you're in that category, you need to change your thinking. So become convinced, understand that that's wrong on a logical, conscious level. But at the same time, well, when that happens, your neurological responses will still not have changed. So they've tested this. And people who are really not racist, still, their brains still don't empathize with people, you know, from another group who suffer. So on that level, the best, or the second part to change that behavior is to expose people to positive interactions with people from other race or other group. I shouldn't even say race. So if you experience positive interactions, now you're seeing this person as a human being. And you're experiencing this person with the same hopes and the same fears and the same aspirations as you have, then that rewiring happens in your brain. And you start to accept this person as in-group. Okay, so that's rewiring. Very briefly, neuroleadership, and I've got about 8 minutes to quickly share this with you. This is a tool, and that's why I included it on that page as well. A guy called David Rock devised the SCARF model, the model that you see there. The SCARF model, basically, what he did is he looked at a lot of research in neuroscience and looked at the social brain, looked at how the brain responds, different studies that look at how the brain responds in social environments. Okay, the fight or flight, the reward or threat or reward in that social environment. And he devised the SCARF model, which proposes 5 needs that your brain and my brain has in the social environment. And so how does this apply to leadership? In the following way. When I interact with people, and if I'm aware of these needs, I can manage my behavior so that I, instead of causing a threat for any of those needs, that I cause a reward response in their brain. So the first need is our need for status. Believe it or not, all of us have a need for status. And this is not monetary status, not financial status, the big car. That's fine as well if you want to have. But it's a need to understand that I'm not at the bottom of the pecking order, to be shown respect. And now think of you can look at the 10 characteristics of servant leadership and start comparing those, throwing those, you know, comparing the two. So the need for respect, the need to be listened to, the need to be involved in decision making. All of that relates to status, our need for status. So if you behave in a way to somebody in a way that compromises their need for status, they feel that, you know, you're not important or we can do without you. Any little remark even can compromise it in that person's brain. What happens? Threat. Label you as a threat. What happens in that person's brain? Threat response. Prefrontal cortex functioning just takes a huge dip. So the ability to think clearly, the ability to solve problems, the ability to remember, the ability to communicate, all of that just takes a dive. Second is our need for certainty, to know more or less what's going to happen next. When we're faced with uncertainty, we feel the threat reward, our brains become activated and wants to activate that threat response. So as a leader, when you interact with people, if you give them a feel or help them to have some certainty. Now, as a leader, some leaders would say, I work with corporates where some of them are struggling and they often say, especially one client that we have, this one particular manager that keeps on reminding his team the whole time that they might not be here this time next year. Now, what does that do? It just diminishes their ability to save the company. I mean, these are the guys who are supposed to save the company. But he's compromising abilities. He's all the time triggering that need for certainty. So as a leader, when we interact as a servant leader, help give people certainty. And of course, from a Christian perspective, what more certainty can you have than what Christ can give us? Autonomy, that's the need to feel that we're in control, that we have some level of control. We don't have to be in control, but that we have some level of control in what's happening to our lives and what's happening around us. So, again, involve people in decision-making. If you think back what I said earlier, that command and control, crack the whip style of leadership, what are you doing? You're taking all control from people. I'm the boss. Always think of the Pope model. The Pope right at the top and the rest down here. And I don't mean it as a comment on anything, just that model of this top person, this great person at the top. And the rest just supposed to be, do as I tell you. The fact is, if you want to get people involved, you want to get the best out of people, give them some involvement in their decision-making process. Again, look at the correlation with servant leadership. I'm thinking of one experiment. What they did is, they took a group of people, gave all of them lottery tickets, said to them, okay, you can win the lottery. So I'm not saying go play the lottery, I'm just citing this experiment. Half the group, the participants, got a lottery ticket a number printed on their ticket. The other half was four empty blocks. And they said to them, okay, you guys, come up with your own lottery number. So they went and they all wrote down lottery number, these guys. Next day, they came back to the guys and said, okay, we've changed our mind. What we want you to do is to give us the tickets back, but we will pay you for them. So they actually paid them real money to buy the tickets that they gave to them the previous day. And what they then found, so then they negotiate with each person individually on the price of these tickets. And what they found, and they've actually done this in different countries, the same experiment, just to test it in different cultures, that on average, when they bought back the tickets from the guys who could fill in their own lottery numbers, they had to pay five times more for those tickets. And it just says a lot about commitment and ownership if people are allowed to be part of the decision-making process. So their level of motivation increased with a factor of five compared to where they were just given the tickets with a number on. There's a number of experiments. I don't have time to share that, but it's really significant. Include people in decision making, and then relatedness is probably apart from status. In my mind, one of the most significant in terms of diversity, in terms of groups, because relatedness is I want to feel I'm accepted by the group. I want to feel accepted in the group. And so anything that makes me feel we are all, you're young, when children tend to do that thing when they argue and they want to manipulate somebody, they say, everyone says you are blah 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 blah. Or everyone says you that everyone use that. Meantime it's one or two people. In the church it also happens. Everyone is wants to change the music or don't want you to change the music or whatever. Using that people's need or actually unconsciously manipulating or threatening people's need to feel, because they're saying everyone feels like this, you pushed out, you're different from the rest, and that activates that response because that need to feel that I'm part of the group, that need to feel inclusive, included, is compromised. So think how you react to people, especially in difficult situations, not to make them feel excluded, not to make them feel threatened, their position in the group threatened. And then finally, fairly easy or to understand, is our need, our brain's need for fairness, so for fair exchanges. But anything that's unfair triggers this response. Guys, I've tried to share with you very briefly what normally takes 2 days. So I've been really pushing it a little bit, but what I hope I've given you is just some idea of the significance of a leadership style. You guys are young, you're making an impact, and you're going to make an impact, and I'm proposing, think about this. Think about how you influence people. Leadership is influence. Leadership is not a position. Leadership is not a title. Leadership is influence. And in this time, we need influences. And as a church, we need to develop influences. We need to be able to influence the world. If you want to influence the world, think about how you do it. And think about what neuroscience is teaching us and giving us at this stage in terms of our ability to be more effective in this. I really believe, I think about this a lot, I really believe it's a part of a process, what science is giving us. It's part of a process of revelation that God has really given us insight into the human mind, the workings of the human mind. Because, interesting, how significant is it that this leadership style, and think about the scarf model, that it so closely correlates with the biblical model of leadership, with the style that the way that Jesus led. So closely, it's not just by coincidence. So understanding and embracing this enables you to manage your own response. So often things happen in my life that triggers the red light. I feel my heart rate. Now I understand what's happening. And just to understand already helps. So I can control it to a certain extent in myself, learn to control it, it's a process, but also manage how I lead when I influence others. Guys, that's it. Time is up. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Marty. That was, I think, very different to the normal leadership talk, but a different angle and very insightful. I think a lot of room to contemplate and think about all the implications of this. You can hop across to Marty's, what is your website?
www.stratleader. I've actually got it there, I think. Let me just quickly.
It's on the notes that you guys have there. Right. And you can look around there, and there's quite a large move in leadership circles about talking about the neuroscience of leadership and various facets of it. And if it's something that's really tickled you and interested in, go read up about it and start studying and getting involved. And I agree with Marnie. There's so many skills that God is holding before us that we need to learn in terms of just good people management and understanding the way He has made people so we can lead His people in obedience to Him.
Dead men to their feet. You are strong, Lord.
Thank you for listening to this message from Shofar Christian Church. We believe that it was time well spent establishing God's kingdom and proclaiming His glory in your life. For more information, call us on 012-362-1363 or email us at pretoria@shofaronline.org. You may also wish to browse our website at www.shofaronline.org or find us on facebook.com/shofarpretoria. There is no one like you.